project, in my mind, means that you should follow at least four important steps, which I've detailed elsewhere, right? The first step is a kind, what I call a necessary therapeutic phase, in order to get rid of several metaphysical pseudo-problems, and in particular, in order to avoid all kinds of usual metaphysical illusions, notably concerning modalities, and even more specifically about realism and reality. The second step, then, implies being able to fix the rules of the a priori method of conceptual analysis, which I intend as, of course, mainly logical, but also that relying on a strict massaging, to take Frank Jackson's expression, of our folk and empirical intuitions, and to be ready to correct them if necessary. Then during the third step of the metaphysical enterprise, or the a posteriori phase, right, it's important to try and test the results of our conceptual analysis and metaphysical concepts with a confrontation with the empirical sciences. And then, and only then, this is the fourth and final step, one could then proceed to what I call the metaphysical commitment proper, which I understand in the following way. I bet on some kind of both scientific and dispositional realism, and opt for what I call a reasoned kind of boldness, midway between humility and, I hope, temerity. So I won't say more today about this program, which I've spelled out, I think, in quite a number of details in another book. But, of course, what I'm going to talk about today is part and parcel of this general framework, right? So, needless to say either that I'm not going to go into the details of all the features of the dispositional realism, which constitutes, indeed, as I said, the general framework of my approach. So, I should say in advance that dispositional essentialism, DE, right, is only one part of it, right? So let me just again briefly say that such a dispositional realism, as I understand it, develops along five main features. In the first place, I don't intend to defend it as a kind of metaphysical realism, but as a scholastic realism, very much inspired by the medievals and borrowing in particular some features of Scotism along the footsteps of Charles Sanders Peirce's re-elaboration of Scotistic realism. Secondly, it's basically a semantic type of realism. The real is, as Peirce said, what signifies something real. What did he... It might be good maybe to say a few words about this. When Peirce said he called himself an Aristotelian of the scholastic wing approaching Scotism, he wanted to stress that contrary to what is often asserted when it comes to the realism-nominalism debate about universals, the problem is not that of wondering whether there exist universals apart from our ideas of words. And one of the most deep-rooted and crude misunderstandings lies, according to him, in believing that the problem has anything to do with Platonic ideas. In fact, the real alternative between esse in anima or esse extra anima is wrong. Universals are undoubtedly words. The question is, words or concepts, the question is, are they only that? So the real opposition should be between nominalists and realists on the question of the fundamental universalitatis. This should be kept in mind because it's an important component of the type of dispositional essentialism I want to try and elaborate. So I quote him, "It must not be imagined that any notable realist of the 13th or 14th century took the ground that any universal was what we in English should call a thing, as it seems that at an earlier age, some realists and some nominalists too had done. Their very definition of universal admits that it is of the same generic nature as a word, namely, quod natum aptum est predicari de pluribus. Neither was it the doctrine that any universal itself is real. There might indeed some of them think so, but their realism did not consist in that opinion, but in holding that what the word signifies, in contradistinction to what it can be truly said of, is real. Anybody may happen to opine that the is a real English word, but that will not constitute him a realist. But if he thinks that whether the word hard itself be real or not, the property, the character, the predicate hardness is not invented by man as the word is, but is really and truly in the hard things and is one in them all, as a description of habit, disposition, or behavior, then he is a realist." So you see, according to Peirce, we should be able to formulate the problem correctly in the following manner. I quote him, "The real is that which is not whatever we may happen to think it, but is unaffected by what we may think of it. So the question, therefore, is whether man, horse, and other names of natural classes correspond with anything which all men or all horses really have in common, independent of our thought, or whether these classes are constituted simply by a likeness in the way in which our minds are affected by individual objects, which have in themselves no resemblance or relationship whatsoever." End of quote. So the fact that, and this is the second feature of the dispositional realism general framework, that it presents itself as a semantic kind of realism implies that, of course, in metaphysics, we must always start from and secure the semantic level first. For example, if the realism we want to defend is some kind of dispositional realism, then we should make our ideas clear about what we say and mean when we claim that there are real dispositions. A direct consequence of this is indeed that any correct account of the role and nature of dispositions should start with the semantic account of dispositional predicates and make sure of the meaning of our dispositional attributions, as Hugh Miller long ago reminded us. And in particular, should try to deal with the reasons why the reduction of dispositional ascriptions to conditionals doesn't seem to work, for example, due to Finkish or antidote cases, or why reduction sentences may or may not tell us all that dispositional predicates mean. Suppose, for example, granted that following Ryle, we didn't want to limit ourselves to mere sparse properties, but also wish at some point, as it is my project in a few months, I hope, also extend this to aesthetic or ethical properties. Suppose then that we know all the manifestations of courage, are going to be able to say what courage means by summing up all the reduction sentences that say what those manifestations are, of course not. A disposition is by essence irreducibly general and indeterminate and cannot be reduced to the mere conjunction of its occurrences. In the third place, such dispositional realism aims at finding genuine properties and not mere predicates, again, as Meller, Ellis, or Mumford rightly insisted on. Properties are not, or are not simply given by the meaning of our predicates. On the contrary, what gives consistency to the referential capacity of our predicates when we use them is that they take for granted the existence, for example, and the identity of planet Mars instead of saying that we use the predicate Mars. In other words, we want our conditionals, such as if X was dropped, it would break, to have truth makers, right? So in the fourth place, and I would add that the type of realism about properties I intend also to defend assumes, and this is important, of course, and I will elaborate this element further on, a causal criterion of existence. In the fourth place, against instrumentalism, it assumes scientific realism as an abductive hypothesis called for by the explanatory necessity of science and commits itself to certain real universals. Fifthly, and this is what I'm going to insist upon today, such a dispositional realism is characterized as an essentialist realism, although a thin essentialism, one which I call aliquiditism, which I could, in a nutshell, summarize the basic principle of. The real dispositions all around us find their intelligibility in the conditional necessity of laws. In turn, laws are a true description of the world only insofar as they are grounded in what things can, or rather would do, as real metaphysical possibilia, close to Persian propensities or would-bes, which are necessary, although discovered a posteriori. And it seems to me that Shoemaker, in his Causality and Properties, came to something rather similar. I quote him in page 232 from Identity, Cause and Mind. Shoemaker says the following: in claiming to know the truth of a singular causal statement, one is not committed to knowing the laws in virtue of which it holds. Moreover, a singular causal statement doesn't commit one to the claim that the instantiation of the relevant properties in relevant similar circumstances always produces the effect that it did in the case at hand. For the laws governing these properties may be statistical, the powers to which the properties contribute may accordingly be statistical tendencies or propensities, and the causation may be non-necessitating. End of quote. So, from the start, I'd like to indicate some important consequences of such a general framework, which will provide us with a few hypotheses I think we ought to explore. So I indicate a few things we have to be, seems to me, careful about. First of all, I take it that properties without which we would have no cognitive access to the things in the world are essentially defined by the dispositions and causal powers they exert. However, so this is a second thing to be careful about, I don't intend to say that reality is entirely constituted by dispositions, nor essentially dispositional. I want to secure two important things. First, the fact that in reality, there are essential properties and there are accidental properties. And I think it is important in any satisfactory definition of essentialism we want to keep these intuitions safe. I think it's important to say why being blonde is an accident property of someone and belonging to the humankind, right, pertains to a more essential property than this. And if we don't stick to these, then I think we are in trouble. So this is something which I think we have to keep from the kind of what Laurie Paul calls the deep essentialist intuitions, right? Okay. And secondly, My contention is that there are not only, as I said, dispositions in reality, there are also, very importantly, laws, which I do not count for in Humean or regularistic terms. Hence, I take it that pan-dispositionalism and even more monistic dispositionalism should be avoided. And this is why I always speak of dispositional realism or at times dispositional aliquidism, not of dispositionalism. Finally, one should always remember there's a lot to be done in order to get from predicates to properties. Hence, one should never take predicates for properties and always be careful to distinguish between the powers and the properties in virtue of which the things that have the powers that they have. So it means that in my own exploration, I try and build on three hypotheses. Following the first one, I feel close in many ways, as some of you will have noted, to some things that have been already said by such philosophers as Brian Ellis, and also to some forms of scientific essentialism, such as have been defended by Mumford, Shoemaker, Burt, or Molnar. Like them, I think that the most important starting point for a correct account of reality is to view it in terms of dispositional properties and causal powers, right? So it seems to me that at least it's important to keep a first criterion of identification for the properties of things, namely the intrinsic causal power of the property. Following Shoemaker, what makes a property the property that it is, what determines its identity, it is the potential it has to contribute to the causal powers of the things which have it. Such a criterion implies several things. First, that in all possible circumstances, two properties, X and Y, contribute in the same way to the causal powers of things, which, if in all possible circumstances, such two properties contribute exactly in the same way, then X and Y are one and the same property. Secondly, at first sight, the causal criterion identifies some intrinsic properties. As you know, Molnar, who defends the view that all properties are powers, insists very much on this. The powers are properties of their bearers. This is one of the fundamental traits which any analysis of powers must prima facie preserve. So there are, nonetheless, few philosophers, McKittrick being one, who holds the view that dispositions might be extrinsic properties, right? The vulnerability of Mona Lisa before it was put under the glass window, for example. However, even if the causal criterion does identify some intrinsic property, it's part and parcel of a cluster of properties and meant in a conditional way. So contrary to the traditional conception of powers in terms of the active-passive distinction or potential-actual distinction, one should insist mostly on two traits of powers, namely their mutuality or reciprocity and their conditionality. No, you remember the examples taken by Shoemaker. Take the property of being a knife. Well, if you only know that property, then you do not know much of what will ensue, depending on the circumstances, from its presence. Maybe it's a steel knife, but after all, it may be made of balsa wood or butter or a strange cloud, taking the strange form of some invisible gas. Talking about mutuality and conditionality of powers means that no power belongs necessarily exclusively to the things that have that property. For example, if it's combined with such properties as having the shape of a knife and to be in steel, then the objects with those properties will by necessity have a certain amount of powers, that of cutting butter, cheese, and wood. If it's applied to such substances with the adequate pressure and also the power to produce in us all sorts of sensible impressions, provided we have the appropriate conditions of observation, or again, the power to leave an impression of a certain shape when applied to soft walks, when it's taken away, etc. Now, if the property knife shape is combined with the property made of glass, one will get another totally different cluster of powers, which will cut across the cluster constituted by its combination with the property made of steel and so on and so forth, for the property made of wood, made of butter, right? So if one follows such a line, then one may say that the identity of any property whatsoever is determined by its causal potentialities, by the contribution it's able to make to the causal powers of the thing that has it. And the causal potentialities, which are essential to a property, correspond to the conditional powers which constitute the cluster with which the property may be identified. So to have a causal potentiality is to be such that anything that has it, a certain conditional power. And this may explain why Burt prefers to use the term potency to the term of power itself. So I make then a second assumption. Such a definition, if we adopt it, captures what is correct in the view as that properties just are powers, that all properties, in a sense, are dispositional, while acknowledging the truth of a standard objection to that view, which Sidney Shoemaker commands upon, and which, of course, we should always pay attention to, namely that a thing's powers or dispositions are distinct from it, because grounded in its intrinsic properties. So it's very important to have, as I said, such a distinction in mind, since what I shall try to show, hence my second assumption, is that even if one grants that a thing is essentially a cluster of causal powers and dispositional properties, on the one hand, it doesn't mean that the essence of a thing, whatever it is reducible to a set of dispositional properties, nor to a set of merely essential properties, in which case we couldn't make sense of the challenge I raised in the beginning, namely how to distinguish essential from accidental properties. And on the other hand, it doesn't mean that I take the whole of reality once again, and even less what constitutes its intelligibility, as being through and through constituted by things which would all be essentially dispositional. Upon dispositional perspective, which is perfectly idealistic and which would involve denying both the relevance of the laws of nature and, as I said, the genuine presence of accidental properties or qualities. Indeed, this is the third assumption I make. One should avoid, as I said, pan-dispositionalism. Now, why? Well, simply because it cannot avoid idealism. Indeed, if one holds that all properties are dispositional, that there are dispositional properties all the way round, as Richard said, yeah, then one faces the risk of a Berkeleyan world with no more distinction between primary and secondary qualities, a circular world in which, as Russell pointed out, all the things will be merely each other's washing, an incoherent world as shown by the counterfactual analysis in terms of possible words, the result of which is the following, as Simon Blackburn has showed. I quote Simon, in supposing a world as entirely described by what is true at neighboring worlds, all these truths in turn vanish into truths about yet other neighboring worlds, and the result is that there is no truth anywhere, end of quote. But in such a world, not only are we obliged to face property which look as if they had been derealized, or in which the concept of truth seems to be inapplicable, but it's also a world in which, as Armstrong noted, the object always contains in itself, in an essential way, a reference to a manifestation which hasn't occurred. It points in the direction of something which doesn't exist. For some, incidentally, intentionality, which Brentano took as a distinctive mark of the mental, directed towards non-existent objects of state of affairs, is a mark not so much of the mental, but as you place observed, of the dispositional. Another challenge for dispositionalism is well known. If all the sparse properties are nothing but powers, all serious distinctions between powers and the manifestations of powers gets lost. So it's hard to model a real happening on such an account. To put it scholastically, the world never passes from potency to act. Nothing ever happens. Unreal, incoherent, unbelievable, well, the world of the pan-dispositionalist doesn't seem to be a very pleasant world to inhabit. Let me just maybe briefly remember, incidentally, what the much regretted Jonathan Low used to say about this. Indeed, it is quite understandable why some philosophers prefer to say that there are no categorical or qualitative properties, but merely powers, or are at least tempted, as John Hale is, to view such powers as qualitative or as having some quantitative aspect. It's not because, in a way, the notion of a property which is not a power applied to a concrete object doesn't make sense, since it would amount to saying that such a property would then be perfectly inert, causally. Now, even such a shape property as sphericity is not a non-power, for this would imply that sphericity has no effect on the causal behavior of a spherical object. Hence, you can even say whether or not the object in question is spherical, since the perception of the properties of an object requires such and such causal interaction between the perceiving object, the perceiving subject, sorry, and the object. Hence, one is led to claim that what it is for an object to be spherical, or part of the essence of sphericity, does consist in the powers an object has in virtue of its sphericity, for example, to roll on an inclined plane, or to project a circular shadow when it is illuminated from a suitable angle, or to appear spherical to a normally sighted person. However, at the same time, as Low adds, who rejects, as you know, dispositionalism, and rightly so, it seems to me, there are several things that shouldn't be confused here. For sure, it's partly because of its powers that a spherical object rolls on an inclined plane, but only partly so. It would not if it was not also heavy and rigid. For example, a spherical soap bubble would not. And it means also that one should not forget to mention other properties of the spherical objects. Namely, we attribute sphericity not only to material objects, but to such things as cavities, holes, or regions of empty space. Now, this doesn't mean anything to say of such things, for example, that they would roll on an inclined plane if they were heavy and rigid, for it is metaphysically impossible for such things simply to roll. A counterfactual of that kind would simply be empty. In other words, we know perfectly well what it is for an object to be spherical, and this has nothing to do with such powers, but rather with the fact that the object in question has a surface whose all points are equidistant from a given point. In short, sphericity as such is a purely geometrical property, fully definable. It's easy to understand, given some basic laws of mechanics, why an object possessing this property, along with rigidity and weight, has a power to roll down an inclined plane, whereas, for example, a cube-shaped object has not. But the power in question is quite distinct from the property of sphericity as such. At most, sphericity is part of the ground of that power in such an object. An object's sphericity by itself confers no specific causal power upon it, but it can certainly contribute to the grounds of an object's causal powers, and in the way, make a difference to the object's causal behavior. But sphericity, again, doesn't have to be some sort of power in order to do this. So rolling as a purely geometrical kinematic definition and is not itself a power to do anything, even if it's no doubt part of the ground of various powers. End of quote. This is the paper published by Low in the collection of essays by Anna Marmoudoro. Hence, I think we should always be very careful to draw a first distinction. Always be careful never to imagine that because we seem to track some dispositionally looking predicate in our language, that it refers to a genuine dispositional property. Sometimes this is obvious with such predicates with able endings, flexible, fusible, soluble, etc. And sometimes, as you know, it's less so. Are color predicates dispositional? Are geometrical predicates, square, triangular, round, golden? Hugh Mellor thinks they can be, right, through a way of counting corners. So, right? So, of course, we've got to take account of such a possibility. But at any rate, it's very important to have the distinctions in mind. A second distinction also should be borne in mind, the one between, as I said, the concept of power and the properties in virtue of which the things have the powers which they have. And this can often be done by saying that the thing has a power when the presence of the power will have given the circumstances such and such effect. In other words, it's always, I think, as Shoemaker insisted on very rightly, to view powers mostly as functions to begin with, and say, for example, to have one's ideas clear, if something is poisonous, its presence in the body of someone will produce death or illness, and that it is in virtue of this that to be poisonous is a power. But it also means that it is thus possible for things to have the same power in virtue of different properties. Indeed, some poisonous substance will kill by affecting the heart, and another poisonous substance will kill by affecting the nervous system. Such substances will have different effects in virtue of different chemical compositions. So such a distinction, again, is to be made, since otherwise, as I said, we shall not be able to show on which basis we should continue to make a distinction between accidental and essential property. Intuitively, as I said, we should stick to such a difference, just as we should also, it seems to me, stick to differences between, on the one hand, sparse or primitive properties, and on the other hand, natural sparse properties and non-natural sparse properties. By what I mean, following the tradition, the fact that not only should the dispositional essentialist take care of what goes on the level of the physical properties, but he should also take care, at least he is in his project, he should pay attention to the, at some point, the testing of his metaphysical intuitions, so to what the various sciences, empirical sciences, can say. Of course, it should at one point pay attention to the level of the properties from other special sciences, by what I mean, not only physics, but of course, chemistry and biology. I mean, I'm not going to deal with this today, but precisely I spent some time last year trying to see in what way we could push the framework in direction not only of physical properties but chemical and biological properties. Okay, right. So this, of course, is important. Now, that being said, I think that we should never forget that it's extremely difficult to find the right type of criteria of identification of a dispositional property. I think, at least I assume, that we should stick to our first assumption, namely that reality is, if not fully, at least very much defined in terms of such dispositional properties and causal powers. And if we didn't assume such a thing, then I must say, but that's, of course, I agree, it's my first presupposition, right? I do not know how we could dream, as I think we should, be doing, of having any kind of cognitive access to the things in the world, since such an access is made possible by their properties, and not any kind of properties, but by such properties whose effects we can measure upon us. So let me summarize what I'm assuming so far. Powers, capacities, dispositions are intrinsic properties of things. The set of manifestations for which a power is made is essential to it. The manifestations of such properties are produced reciprocally through mutual interactions. In other words, if the salt is to manifest its solubility in water, then water is to manifest its power of reacting. For salt to dissolve, this is imperative. Powers must go together in order to produce their manifestation. Now, suppose we grant at least this and agree on such an overall dispositional realist framework. Well, beside the question of the identification and individuation of their various powers and dispositions, we face immediately a challenge, which is the following. How are such causal powers and dispositions supposed to work together in order for the puzzle, so to speak, to constitute an harmonious whole, and without having the impression that all this is magical or mysterious glue, right? Indeed, even if we assume that the best way to characterize the real properties of things is in terms of dispositions and causal powers, it doesn't follow that all the dispositional properties of an object are, as I said, essential to it. For example, the fact that X is hard is not necessarily essential to X, even if hardness is a property that causes X to behave in some predictable way. At any rate, if we cannot identify the real nature of a thing, the essential meanings of the concept of that thing with anything else but the complete set of the habits, dispositions that govern its behavior, the risk is that it may then become impossible to distinguish again between the essence of an object and its accidents. Now, if what we want again is to have a fully realized world and not a mere mosaic of arbitrary chunks of things, of static quiddities, or mere bundles of habits, merely fixed by again some mysterious glue, then we need some account of the real binding between all those things. And if most components of the real are viewed as entirely reducible to sums of causal powers, how are such causal powers to be bound together in turn? And once again, how are they going to be really causal? As one can see, it's very likely that something more will be needed than mere causal powers, and also more probably than mere efficient causation. In short, we will have to understand the way all these powers hang together so as to provide a sufficiently strong synchronic unity of the things and of the entities which are the bearers of such properties. For an important part, indeed, and I shall not dwell on this today, the causal interactions between the properties themselves on which the laws of nature supervene provide the overall unity and harmony of the whole, of what are called the cement of things. But something more than the causal interactions on the one hand and the laws on the other hand is needed. And it's here precisely that assume that essentialism, some kind of essentialism must play some role. The question is, what kind of essentialism and how should we conceive it?